Hello, everybody. I'm Kate Wright. I'm working with Steve Witters and also our other friend Peter Hall, coordinating the Community Garden Project. This seminar is part of some of the celebrations around the Open Day, which is tomorrow at 1 p.m. at Duty Park Oval, next to Duty Park Oval, parking via Main Street. I'll talk more about that later, but for now I'd just like to introduce Steve Witters to do a welcome to country.
Whereabouts, Kate, just there?
Yep.
Is there a mic?
Yeah, that's me.
I think people can hear me anyway, can you?
Yes.
Good day.
Good day.
Yagadanya, Nanyawanya. Yunyara, Danyatampida, Urila, Runyara, Danyawanya. Welcome, everybody. That translates to I am a man of the Annamun people, the traditional custodians of this land. And I would like to welcome you all here to the land of my ancestors, here, the Annamun people. I'd also like to acknowledge that this land is surrounded by groups of other Aboriginal people, like the Goombanga, the Dungutti, the Kamilaroi, the Biripi, and the Bundjalung, just to name a few. We were all, at one time, we were all connected by songline. All connected by songline. These days, we're connected by online. But but the fact remains that we're connected by land, by our relationship with the land, relationship with the water, relationship with the environment and the ecology of everything. We have some connection. Whether I'm an Annamun man from here or a Runta man from Central Australia or a Noongar man from Western Australia, we are all connected. And the one thing that connects us is our relationship with the land that we're on. It has many meanings to us, a sacred land. It defines us as individuals, as people of a group of Aboriginal people, and of our connection with the land, the environment, the sky, the water, the animals, everything. On this little patch of land that we call the Annamun land, or Nanyawanya, it's just easier to say Annamun, and it's more familiar to Armidale people, Annamun, but the traditional name is Nanyawanya. We have a responsibility, as my ancestors have had, to look after the land and everything that goes with it. And that includes everything that is put into the land and everything that is brought out of it. My ancestors, I'm carrying on a tradition today that my ancestors have done for thousands of years. They respect the land, they welcome people who come to it, they ask you that you respect it as well. And in a gesture of goodwill and in the spirit of friendship, as Aboriginal people have done for thousands of years, I'd like to welcome you, as my ancestors have done. We're here today to commemorate, or are we commemorating it yet, or what? Probably a bit too early to commemorate, but certainly to celebrate over the next 2 days the opening of the community garden at East Armidale. But the community garden is not just a community garden. There's a lot that comes with it. And I just come from a radio interview and I pronounce that by saying not only does it tell you about the link with the land, and that's reflected on the Aboriginal flag, the black on the top, the red on the bottom for the land, and the yellow in the middle for the sun, which symbolises the giver of life. Without the sun and without that good relationship with the land and the people, we're not going to exist. And my ancestors have been resilient, and they've practiced sustainability, looked after ecology and everything that goes with it for thousands of years. For us to be still here today, to be the longest, oldest surviving culture of any culture in the world. But it's not just about, and you'll hear from other speakers too, but I'd like to get in first from an Aboriginal point of view. It's not just about getting your hands dirty and growing vegetables and fruit and flowers and herbs. It's also about appreciating the animals, the insects, the relationship with the environment and the sky. I always say that the Aboriginal people, they were the best astronomers going. Before Galileo, before all of those people who used to look up in the sky, the Aboriginal people have done it for thousands of years, many thousands. We need to reclaim that connection with astronomy and with the ocean and primarily with the land as well, because that's just our existence. It's everything. But it's not just about getting the hands dirty and building gardens and bringing self-respect and self-confidence and pride in culture back to a community. And I'm not just talking about Aboriginal community here. I'm talking about the whole of community. And we're very fortunate here in Armidale to have such a diverse community. I'm involved in some multicultural groups. And in Armidale, we have 88 different nationalities. And that's only at one school. So we've got a great diversity here of cultures that can contribute and can be part of the community garden. And community is about, it's not new, communal living is not new. My ancestors have done it for thousands of years and they've worked together with common goals to make sure that they maximise the benefit for their communities. And I like the idea of this community garden because it will bring back a lot of things that we've lost, like self-respect, like self-confidence, like community confidence, and a love of the land, and of seeing results from efforts that are put in. And as we move into the modern ages, something that we have to be quite aware of and be part of, because when you think about it, we are what we eat, and we are also what we drink and everything like that. But I'd just like to touch on a little bit of the, you know, I said, for thousands of years, my ancestors and the ancestors of all the other Aboriginal groups in Australia have looked after the land. They've nurtured it, maintained it, and they've been resilient. They talked about climate change well before the politics started coming in talking about climate change. They were adaptable and they lived here. In what is probably the most arid and driest land on earth, but they survived because they had that good management. They were the greatest conservationist in the world and the greatest environmentalist in the world and the greatest hydrographers in the world. They knew it. They knew it all and they survived here for a long time. But more recently and more locally, at Narwin Village, and Narwin is named after the Anarwin at East Armidale, used to be called the East Armidale Reserve, the Aboriginal Reserve, back in the old days in the late 1950s. There was a doctor in Armidale, Dr. Helen Kent Hughes, who probably delivered every Aboriginal kid born in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s in Armidale. She had a long association with the Aboriginal community. Back in 1960, there were 5 Aboriginal kids died of gastroenteritis and of they become sick with conditions that could easily have been prevented. And there was a call, she was the deputy mayor of Armidale, and there was a call for her to look after the Aboriginal people in the town, who at that time were living next door to a rubbish tip. And their home was referred to as the tip, or the dump. They were living there, and the welfare authorities, the Aboriginal Welfare Board, and the council decided to build 14 houses out at East Armidale. And it was called the East Armidale Aboriginal Reserve, the reservation. Over the years it's been called different names, Silver City, because all the houses were silver, and then they were all painted, then it was called Rainbow Ridge. The people who lived there gave it that name, and now it's called Narwin Village to honour the traditional owners. But at the time there was a call by the elders on the village to start growing their own vegetables, providing their own food, looking at the nutrition. Dr. Kent Hughes set up a soup kitchen out there and the Save the Children the Fund come along and established a preschool, which has over the years evolved into Minimbar School across the road from where the original place was. The idea was to teach parents and children about good food preparation, nutrition, and to give that community pride in where you live. So they had competitions amongst each other about who had the best garden, front and back. flowers, herbs, vegetables, decorations, ornaments, everything. And that really brought so much pride to the community there. It just changed the whole aspect of 1 minute living on the dump to having your own house and having your own pride and having particular interest in you and your family, as our ancestors have done for thousands of years. So it's not new. The sense of community was always there. We're re-enhancing it, reclaiming it, and this is a start. We want to invite people to be involved in it because it's got a lot of social benefits as well when people come together. And there has been, let's be honest, there has been a lot of division in the Aboriginal community, and there is a great potential there for not only the Aboriginal community but every other multicultural person in this town and beyond to become part of the one community. And I think getting your hands dirty and learning a lot about the relationship with the land is a good thing to do. So I'm part of it, and thanks Kath for inviting me, and thanks Peter for helping me with it, and all the other partners as well. Tomorrow, we're going to use the theme from little things, big things grow. And it's going to symbolise, that we plant the seed. Not necessarily literally, but we're planting the seed and we want it to grow. But it can only grow through the interest and support of people like yourselves who actually have that interest to come there. So it's not just an economic thing, it's a social thing. It's a good community project, and I'm into that. And there's my clock telling me I've probably talked too long. But look, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your interest, and I'd like to extend my welcome on behalf of the traditional custodians of the land here and the water and everything around us, as my ancestors have done, welcome you all here today. Just as a matter of interest, for those who don't know, we're in the Arala Centre. That's a word from the Anawan language. It means a place to learn. And just up the road, there's the Bulumimba Centre, which is also an Anawan word, which means place of wild apples. So the wild apples were grown here. They didn't have to be planted. They were just growing here. They were native. So Bulumimba is an Aboriginal name, Anawan name. So it's good that the university have adopted or kept some of those traditional names, and we have to get back to traditional ways. Anyway, thank you for the invitation, Kate, and everybody else who's involved, and Kate's going to talk more about that. And welcome, everybody. Welcome to the land of the Anawan people. And I trust that you will show your respect and enjoy it. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you, Steve. That was fantastic and really interesting to hear again all about the history of that block. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name's Kate, as I said before. My position here is a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Arts. But the way that this whole thing came about was I met Steve during my PhD research. Steve was setting up some interviews with some Aboriginal elders, and at that time Steve said to me, I really like this idea of a garden. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a fantastic thing to be involved with. So when the opportunity came up to do a postdoctoral research project that would involve being outside with plants and connecting with people, I thought, oh, that sounds really great. So I ran with it, and UNE picked it up, and here I am doing this, which is great. So I guess I want to explain a little bit my sort of where my research is coming from and where I see the garden going as a future, not just as a future thing with a lot of social and environmental importance, but a future thing that has the potential to reframe what we do as academics and as researchers. So my work is situated in the interdisciplinary field of environmental humanities, which some of you may have heard of. And the environmental humanities is really focused on cracking open and breaking up divides between things like sciences and arts, between humans and non-humans, between people and the environment. and bridging the gap between Western, Eastern and Indigenous ways of understanding the natural world. Obviously, a garden, because it's so much about connection, is a great place to explore all those ideas. I should say a little bit about who has been involved in the development of the garden so far. So obviously UNE has a big role to play and lots of people from Arala have been involved. We've had Minambar school kids painting the garden beds, which has been really sweet. We've had Jobs Australia and Best Employment having worked for the Dole crews that are also doing TAFE traineeships at the site. So it's really brought together all these different organisations, and then we've also had volunteers involved and individuals beyond empathy doing some artistic stuff. So it really has become a vibrant space of connection. But I'm thinking about connection here as not just connecting community, but connecting community as something that's more than human. So connection as being something, or community as being something that recognises, as Steve was saying, the importance of insects, the importance of plants, the importance of weather, and how all those things can be considered, you know, vital parts of community. I'm thinking about the possibilities this garden could create, not just from a community development perspective, but as a space that offers us ways of thinking about more than human ways of conducting research. What does it mean to think with plants and soils? What would a eco sort of model of intellectualism look like? What could this do to the way we think, write, imagine, to the way we listen, to what we hear and feel? And as it is the International Year of Soils, I'm going to frame this around that visceral, earthly substance of soil. So, I just realised I entirely forgot that I had a PowerPoint. Anyway. Soil. So that's that's the garden pretty much as it is at the moment. I think a little bit more has been done. They're the beds that were painted by the Minambar kids. And come along on Saturday and check it out in the real world. Anyway, soil. Okay. When I first saw the garden site, it was actually covered in mounds of soil. Not nice soil like this, but soil like this. Basically, it was being used as an illegal dumping ground, and the soil there was filled with, you know, broken glass, cans, that's a bit of cement, loose cement that was there. It was all this rubbish and refuse, bits of hose and tyre, bits of metal, looked pretty bad, right next to people's homes. Because of that, we had to test it for contamination, which was a very nerve-wracking process. Because if there was asbestos or something in it, you know, the whole project was in jeopardy. And I think that really indicates how soil is like the lifeblood of a garden. It's sort of its flesh, and it's intimately connected to, you know, everything that grows from it. So it's kind of, soil is a reminder of, the importance of recognising connection. So also in those piles of earth was a reminder that the old reserve site was stained with a memory of ecological and social neglect. Just as contaminated soils of an old garbage dump carry remnants of asbestos or lead in the molecular structure decades after the rubbish is gone, the trauma of the past infects the present with a toxicity that seeps into places and communities. As Steve spoke about, reserves were historically used to isolate, confine and control Aboriginal people with devastating effects on social connectivity and cultural continuity. And this is an article I came across just Googling, and it was from 1960 in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it talked about what it was like living on the Armidale Aboriginal Reserve. Article focused on the outbreak of disease in the warm weather due to a lack of hygiene and very poor living conditions. It describes the area, home to over 150 people, as a disease-ridden shanty town located on an old garbage dump. And the mayor of the Armidale at the time, Alderman PJ Love, was deploring the lack of commitment from the government to addressing urgent threats to the health and well-being of residents, particularly children. He said, since the area was declared a reserve in November 1958, the government has added only 6 water taps. 3 months ago, the entire population shared only one tap and had done so for at least 10 years. It would cost about £3,000 to sewer the reserve. This was a small amount when it could save the lives of young children, he said. I came across this term recently. It's called root shock. It's when you move plants from one area to another, like if you're taking them out of a pot to a garden. And what happens to the plants is the leaves yellow and wilt and dry out because the plant is struggling to establish roots in new soil. And that concept of root shock was taken by, was sort of transplanted itself from botany to sociology by Mindy Fullerlove to explain the experience of humans who are displaced from their homeland. People who are uprooted from their home place suffer traumatic stress, profound grief, and an existential attack on sense of self with ripple effects on entire communities that ricochet down decades. Aboriginal people confined to reserves, I think you could say, suffered that sort of root shock. There was a sense that the land and culture was so violently assaulted, and people were, you know, stripped of their right to freely move through what was their own sovereign country. So what I'm sort of getting at is that the soil contains this really troubling history. There's sort of trauma in it, there's blood in it, it contains all that depth. But soil also always contains hope, because soil is where you plant new seeds. Soil is a space of growth. Soil always contains the past and the future. There are burial grounds in soil, but soil also needs to be healthy because new life grows from it. Soil is the space where death transforms into life, where the dead become ecological gifts to the living. And soil itself is a heaving multiplicity of life, a rhizomatic underworld of roots and microorganisms that are invisible to our eyes but are fundamental to our health. We are all really intimately connected with soil and these more than human stories of life and death. And there's this great TED talk, I recommend looking it up. It's by a guy called Ron Finley, and he's a self-described guerrilla gardener, and he plants veggie gardens in south central LA. And he has this line in the talk where he says, to change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. And when I heard it, I just thought it was a really arresting line. I couldn't stop thinking about it. To change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. It's a statement that says a lot, I think, about the idea of community as something that's multi-species, about the connection between people and place, about the host of organisms that define how we relate to each other. It brings this idea of community, which is so often too focused only on the human and neglect of the more than human world, back down to earth. But what does it actually mean to be down to earth, to be grounded, to think with soil? I think that soil shows us the way that everything's connected, the past and the future, the plants and the weather, the dead and the living. This is one of the Clontarf boys painting a bit. Australian Aboriginal philosophy has one of the most intricate and sophisticated understandings of ecological interconnection on the planet. As Steve was talking about, the flag itself is a great representation of that. Connections are forged between people and place, between the celestial movements of skies and patterns of seasons, between animals and plants, and these rich webs of connectivities are noticed and responded to and respected through a process of listening to country, through being immersed in what environmental philosopher and anthropologist and my dear PhD supervisor, Debbie Rose, calls creature languages, which is a vast range of semiotic processes beyond but including the human. But despite a recognition and a growing recognition of the environmental intelligence that's embedded in Aboriginal cultures, Indigenous scholars continue to lament the exclusion of Indigenous methodologies and knowledges from the academy. Black American feminist Audre Lorde once said that the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. I think that the tools that perpetuate social and environmental injustice are Eurocentric, anthropocentric and phallocentric ways of thinking that deeply inscribed into the West's stories, into our language, into our institutional structures. They're this kind of logic of capitalism and materialism and neoliberalism, and it seeps into everything and presents the living world, sort of wondrous living world, as some kind of inert resource. And this is part of what well-known ecological feminist Val Plumwood referred to as a crisis of reason, an ecological crisis of reason, which is basically a pathology. It's a pathology in our thinking and understanding, and it now threatens the future of our own and many other species. Naomi Klein recently observed that our economic system of capitalism, defined by endless growth, and our ecological system, defined by limits and thresholds, are at war. So as scholars in both the natural and social sciences struggle with questions of how to live ethically and sustainably in a climate-changing world, local grassroots initiatives like community gardens are proliferating across the globe in challenge to these neoliberal systems of consumption. And I think we need to engage with what's going on there. So I'm looking at this garden with its rhizomatic soils that will grow this more than human community as a place to experiment not only with alternative lifestyles, but with new ways of doing research, to question what counts as data, what can be understood as legitimate knowledge. Plants and insects in this space become research collaborators and teachers. Seasons and elements like rain become active community members. In this sort of little pocket of research that's beyond the campus but connected to it, it might be possible to cultivate new modes of attentiveness to the natural world, to split open and dig up ways of thinking that are not working, to learn to think connection, to dwell with soil. And I think in that soil and in that space, there's the possibility for healing some of those ongoing colonial wounds and for taking a pocket of wounded country through a grassroots, community-directed garden and revegetating it, reclaiming it. But at the same time, there's also a possibility for healing part of that pathology that I'm talking about in our thinking. For healing the sickness that dismisses the importance of place, of environment, and of the songs and stories of the non-human inhabitants with which we share the earth. So, yeah, essentially what I'm getting at is that tilling these soils that hold this very complex, troubling and traumatic past might nourish more hopeful and just futures. Cheers. And I'd like to introduce Mark Shepherd. Just bring up. From the Department of Agriculture and Law?
The School of Law, yeah.
School of Law.
Right, I'll just get myself organised here. Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. Just like Kate, I am also a UNE postdoctoral fellow, but based in the School of Law. And the work that I'm doing is not so much at the local level, but working with major institutional conservation seed banks. So these are the seed banks that are attached to the large botanical gardens around the nation. And I'm working with them in relation to their collections management processes, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a few moments, and introducing notions of appropriate stewardship of traditional knowledge into their collections management systems. So one thing in particular that these seed banks are increasingly turning their focus to the collection of seed from Indigenous lands. There's a variety of reasons for this, but two that I want to draw on particularly this morning are increased emphasis on the conservation of crop wild relatives, and secondly, emphasis on developing seed collections that have a role in supporting food security and future economic uses of plant genetic resources. So I think, and I'd like to thank Steve, in your introduction you talked about responsibility and respect, and I think in many ways that probably covers a lot of what I'm going to talk about, so maybe I can sit down now. But in relation to these seed bank institutions, we're talking about developing perhaps operational protocols in some form that try and deal with some of these concepts of respect, try and deal with notions of responsibility. I'm in the law school, so we're very interested in how responsibilities get transferred from, you know, ideas into action. Getting sort of notions of getting institutions that are very heavily botanically based and science focused to incorporate some more ethical aspects of dealing with people into their operations. So what I'm talking about is building better relationships surrounding the status and use of indigenous ecological knowledge in collections management systems. Collections management systems is a term that the seed banks use, and what they're talking about is a process that's linked up from the collection of seed to taking that seed back to the seed bank facility, its storage, its cataloguing, its ongoing management while it's stored, and the data that's associated with the seed, and then the ongoing use of that of those seeds and the information that's associated with them. Thanks. So one of the things that I'm interested in is conceptualising this relationship between seed banks and the source communities from where they're gaining seed, is a relationship that's conceptualised on respect for trust, legitimacy, cultural norms and equity, principles of equity. Essentially, it's a performance management issue for seed bank institutions that may be viewed in the sense of broadening their bottom line beyond just purely an interest in the botanical to include socio-cultural aspects of their operations. So I can argue that relationships of this nature between conservation seed banks and communities in seed source areas are important for the overall risk management of those institutions. And what I mean by risk is, you know, what is the risk of these institutions, very large and very significant institutions with important roles in the biosecurity of our country? What is the risk of them not incorporating concerns about people and their knowledge and how that is appropriately handled into their business operations? So this reflects a reality that seed banks become stewards of not just seeds but associated knowledge that goes with those seeds. And it's inevitable that if they're increasingly collecting seeds associated with wild relatives of food and fibre crops, native species that are increasingly collected on indigenous lands. And the reason for that is, as one person in a seed bank explained to me, they've done a lot of the easy stuff. They've been through national parks, they've been through more developed lands and collected seeds from stock reserves and roadsides. But, there's with increasing focuses on impacts of climate level changes and needs to support food security concerns into the future, there's a need for these institutions, there's a recognised need that crop wild relatives, a lot of native species, are underrepresented in these collections, and so there's a very important emphasis on getting those species represented in seed bank collections, and not just in seed bank collections, but also in on-site collections, conservation in the landscape itself, rather than just being transported to a seed bank facility. So why are these things are important? What are some of the trends that are suggesting that these sorts of issues are important? Well, one is that there's increasingly stringent obligations that are associated with seeds and seed banking. There's international obligations that are associated with the collection of genetic material and associated knowledge. And these establish global norms of access and use that need to be implemented domestically. Initially, the Convention of Biological Diversity, after about 10 years, it established the Bonn guidelines, which were voluntary guidelines that were dealing with collection of material and knowledge, prior informed consent and benefit sharing. But yes, they were just that. They were voluntary, they were guidelines. So it was up to member states, governments to decide whether or not they would adopt them. Surprise, surprise, that approach hasn't worked that well. In a global context, Australia's been quite a strong adopter of these sorts of principles into law. So I guess we've been ahead of things in many ways. What I mean by that is that Australia already has processes in place under legislation that deal with seed collection and getting prior informed consent and access and benefit sharing arrangements in place. But in a bigger context, globally, a voluntary approach hasn't really worked that well. So we now have binding obligations in the Nagoya Protocol, which is an instrument made under the Convention of Biological Diversity. And that's an acknowledgement that voluntary implementation hasn't really worked. And the Australian government's currently developing its implementation and adoption arrangements for the implementation of the Nagoya Protocol. So it covers things like getting access to plant genetic resources, fair and equitable sharing of benefits arising from use of genetic resources, and compliance with prior informed consent and mutually agreed terms of transfer. And as I said, Australian law is already relatively inclusive of many of those obligations. So the second aspect of this is that there is the ethics and performance management aspect, or the socio-cultural bit of sustainability. Ethical standards are becoming more and more prominent in public and private sectors as they seek to demonstrate performance that is in some way sustainable. Now, these may be regarded as indeterminate concepts or weasel words, but there's growing evidence that rights, justice, fairness, and a precautionary approach to risk are being increasingly used to hold researchers and the institutions that they work for to account for the activities that they undertake, particularly in relation to genetic resources. And the examples there are more related, I guess, to animal genetic resources, but also to the sorts of protest activities and civil unrest associated with genetic modification. So there are guidelines already, such as the ATSIS Ethical Research Guidelines, which are out there and in use, and it may be the case that conservation seed banks in our major botanical gardens need to be more attentive to those sorts of documents and perhaps formally adopt them. Another reason for looking at performance management is annual reporting requirements are evolving and broadening in scope so that there's more of a general interest in the development of social well-being and capacity in local communities, and seed bank collections are not exempt from this. So operationally, for seed banks, what this means is that is building partnerships underpinned with trust and confidence, I would suggest, and that recognise the social foundations of knowledge. So it is probable that conservation seed banks will be called to account for their collections management performance against such standards. And you'll see up there there's an annual report picture. And these are the sorts of things that are increasingly being used to communicate social performance or aspects of social performance of institutions. But it's not only annual reporting that we're talking about. We've already looked at some international obligations, and these get turned into domestic laws and regulations. There are contracts associated with exchange of seeds and knowledge, professional standards to do with the way that people carry out their work and perhaps even seek accreditation for what they do professionally, are increasingly looking to adapt ethical components. There's also already existing common law obligations that deal with sort of trusteeship or proper relations between people in undertaking sort of business transactions. And already we see institutional ethics codes, again, like the ATSIS ones. But one aspect of importance in relation to seed banks and in a climate of decreasing funds is that funding agreements are increasingly seeking better outcomes for the investments that are made. And so there's I guess, a fiscal sort of element to it. Because, and particularly since seed banks are now promoting themselves as being repositories of more and more of genetic resources that are important in terms of food and fibre production, or potential future production, and also these sources of Indigenous knowledge that go with that. And the last part of this slide is to do with data. So, I mean, knowledge, I guess, in the simplest way, is conceptualized as data. It's associated data that's associated with the seed when it's collected. And in a digital and networked world, there's an emphasis on making data readily available. So typically, knowledge that's collected with a seed may be part of a data set that's linked to the sample, and that could potentially find itself being made available online, perhaps in an open access type of situation. So it's inevitable that in their business, seed bank staff will come into contact with traditional knowledge in some way, and that it's possible that it could be collected or stored, but there's really no set guidelines at present. This is something that's left up to the individual discretion of the person who receives the knowledge. So there's a very high risk, I guess, is my point, that knowledge may be exposed and used in possibly an inappropriate way. We had a bit of a get-together in Canberra last year with people from seed banks and other interested persons, and one of the things that came out of that was looking at some of the challenges that arose from this sort of work. One would be that essentially knowledge might be functional ecological knowledge that could be stored as part of a data set with a seed that relates to the way that it grows, how it germinates, what it might be potentially useful for, but not be culturally significant knowledge. And then there's culturally sensitive knowledge, which is the sort of knowledge that should be not necessarily collected at all, or if it is collected, that it should be handled in an appropriate way. Another one of the challenges is one of having appropriate partnerships with trusted institutional collections. That sort of idea that if you are carrying out your business in a responsible way, collecting and storing and using data in a way that is not breaching obligations, that you're likely to be trusted as a responsible institution that deserves to have access to seed be able to deal with that in an appropriate way. There's also more of a practical purpose in terms of access and benefit sharing arrangements, and that's having an appropriate way to track the links between genetic resources, the knowledge that's associated with those, and the ongoing future uses. And if those can be clearly linked up through a collections management system, there's a much greater chance that any future, maybe currently unknown uses of seeds are able to be traced back to traditional knowledge if there are such links in that chain. So what are we doing in conclusion? We're working with the Australian Seed Bank Partnership, which, as I've said, well, I haven't said, but what the Australian Seed Bank Partnership is a industry relationship between the major seed conservation banks, a network, that was the word I was looking for. They have national coverage. All the big capital city institutions are part of that, and they're a body that's been set up by the heads of Australian Botanic Gardens. What are we doing with them? We're looking at their collections management systems. To recap, that's the seed collection, the cataloguing, storage, and then ongoing access and use of seeds and seed data. And we're looking at that in terms of who are the people that are involved in all of these processes. So not just thinking that seed banks are going out to collect seed samples and document the data that's associated with that, but they're dealing with people, that they're dealing with people who understand and have an appreciation of ecological systems, that the information that's associated with that seed is in a way a part of that whole relationship between people and land and environment. So who are those people that are involved? What are their different roles? And what sort of expectations do they have? What are the risks that come from all these different relationships? And what is the capacity of the collections management system within institutional seed banks to incorporate these sorts of ethical issues and the risks that are associated with them? So that is pretty much what my project is about. So thank you.
A minute or so it's my great pleasure to introduce, who probably needs no introduction, Costa from ABC's Gardening Australia. And I actually don't know how to pronounce your surname. I think it's Georgiadis.
No, actually, I don't have to apologise because I don't have a PowerPoint. Spark something there about getting on the carbon and doing things. Back in November 1991, I was working in Austria and I was building these eco ponds and rooftop gardens, so probably about 20 years. And I remember I was driving outside of Vienna, I was about 4 hours out of, no, 2 hours out of town. I was driving in this little village, there were all these plum trees. So I've just gone, like, you know, I just got up there and I picked up all these plums and put them in the truck, had the bobcat on the back, and I'm driving back to town, banging away on these plums, it was beautiful. Got into the company workshop, and there's the workshop boss, comes right about, what have you been up to? He says, picking people's plums. What's the point? That's a community garden. The walls have eyes when there's community value. So someone saw that. They saw the name Bio Top on the side of the truck and then just thought, bam, kick that guy's butt. Because he's not supposed to take our stuff. So I'll come back to that, but it really sparked a point there, right? Because that's the width and breadth of a community garden. It's not It's not confined to what you may think you see defined as a community garden. And when people put the value on it, all bets are off. All bets are totally off. Now, just to start with, Steve, thank you for the wonderful welcome to country. It's a pleasure to be here. And I've just learned so much in my travels around the country over the last probably 8 years. And to be able to be welcomed to country is a wonderful privilege. And to acknowledge country is something that I'll make sure that I do in my limited capacity wherever I go. Because you jump in this tin can and you fly. I was in Sydney this morning and I fly over all these people's country and I just land here. And it's really nice to get to understand, as you said, that connection to land. And I don't just barge through your house at 7 o'clock in the morning on my way through. So, yes, thank you for that wonderful welcome. And as you said, the relationships that connect us, they begin right from the moment that we get together. And I like the fact that you talk about communal living not being new. I think we've been sold very much a consumption consciousness that is geared at putting us all in little separate boxes. And when you talk about communal, then we start to break these boxes down. Kate, I loved your talk. I love the vocabulary of your talk, and vocabulary is going to be one big thing that I talk about for the next couple of minutes. I went and visited Ron Finlay, lovely fella. I went out for lunch when one of his staff were leaving. I just happened to turn up at that time and they took me out. I think I had the best Mexican meal I've ever had in LA. And he is an amazing guy, and his basic tenet is that he's a gangster gardener. And he says, you've got to make gardening gangster. If you want to get the gangsters off the street, you've got to talk their language. Can't get there and go happy, happy kumbaya. let's all sing and plant the soil. Like, it ain't going to happen. And he's doing it, and he's doing a great job. So I really enjoyed that, and I loved your point about root shop. We can use terms, we can use vocabulary, and that's what we have to do, because you know, the vocabulary I'm going to use here is going to be the vocabulary that's going to be here. You know, we've got to talk different depending on what we're trying to say. You know, I mean, Urala? Is it Urala? Urala. Yeah, I just like the fact that I learned what that meant. You know, it's a place of learning. It's a privilege to be in this place of learning. And to listen to all the speakers today and have them fire up. I don't have to think much about talking on this topic because I live it every day. But when we talk about the concept of the community garden, I ask you, or I tell you, the community garden has so many different shapes and sizes. It can be that pot plant on your balcony. It can be that windowsill pot with a few herbs. It can be your small garden in a courtyard. It can be a rooftop. It can be a vertical wall. It can be your backyard that's a community garden for your family. It could be your streetscape, where I've been doing a lot of verge gardening, nature strip gardening. And people then can relate to that as our street communities garden. And then it can be a more traditional community garden that's been set up with the help of the council, or set up with an organisation. Or it could be community gardens out in Yarra, where the church, you know, you look at some of these churches around the country, and they've got car parks the size of this campus. And they go, oh, well, let's put a community garden in there. And the point about Yarra that I love, I went there to launch it, and in the week before the launch, they put a couple of scarecrows in front of the garden. And I was arriving on a Saturday, put them out on a Thursday night, and it rained. And on the Friday morning when they turned up to put some more signs and do some things, scarecrows had raincoats on. Because the community garden's opposite the pub. And the people that were in there drinking thought, well, we better do something. There's community outreach going straight away. A And that is that's it in a nutshell. That's ownership, because the first thing people do with the unit is they get scared. They go, what if I put a street guard on? And I spoke to all the people in my street because I had to. The first answer I go, what if someone takes the food? No. Might be good if they eat it. But then the next one, what if someone vandalizes? Well, if we take ownership of it, then think about a pub. You've got people coming in at 4 p.m. and you've got security then until probably 2 a.m. Eyes on it the whole time, but never had a problem. So then you can go to another level of a community garden. You can talk about schools. Schools are a wonderful community garden. It's a school community. Then that branches out, and the more you teach in that garden, the more you're teaching and influencing. There's nothing better. Getting into the minds of children. You might get it into their parents, but they don't have to knock on the door and the kids take it home in their school bag. And they say, hey, I want to make a little patch. I want to grow some things. So a school garden is a wonderful place to reflect on what community is. Now, what I want to do is just run through a couple of examples that I've experienced of late to give you an idea of this breadth. Last week I was at Layla Park Community Garden in Sydney. Why did I want to go there and do a story? I wanted to do a story there because I heard that they're doing an after-school program. When you think about after-school, what are kids pushed into? More study, more tutoring. You've got to play violin, piano, harmonica, squeeze box, on top of doing 4 afternoons of study and then play school sport and this and that and the other. What a wonderful thing that this garden has set up a schools program where kids can come after school and they learn arts, crafts, learn how to plant, learn how to make compost, they go an aquaponics system. All of a sudden, they're in a different team. They're in a garden team, not a sports team. Wonderful thing. And a wonderful thing that I share with other communities to say that any one of you sitting in this room, you go down to your local community garden and say, hey, I'm happy to volunteer one afternoon a month and I'll teach you something. And it could be your skill, in fermenting. You might have just done cheese making course. You might be into compost teas and biological farming. Whatever it is. Mosaic, art. You know what they did? I got there, they took a photo of me. One lady took a photo of me. Within an hour, she's done this whole portrait. You'll see it on the show. It's unbelievable. Put it in the Archibald. Although, actually, I actually got painted for the World Arches. And the World Arches, no one has to get your permission. They can just paint you. And so I was in the World Arches. And I kept getting all these texts. Oh, I just read this article. And finally, someone sent me a picture. And you'd love it. Take a picture of me. I'm sitting in the middle of a veggie patch. I've got a big piece of cabbage and I'm doing this one with a big smile on my face. So it's kind of like, I was happy. It's getting the message across. Humanura, we've got to talk about that. We've got to bust it. We've got to bust this. Roman. You know, think about our sewer system is Roman. We put our waste in water and then take it away and then try and separate it. Like, it's crazy. So a community garden is a place where we can start to change this. I've seen lots of community gardens with compost in the toilets. And you're going to go, put some sawdust on there. But how do you break this conditioning? How do you change the vocabulary? You're changing in places that are not intimidating. Gardening is the most not intimidating thing. I can go into any place and go there. That means the university, that's where. I can go into any place and I can talk about anything related to gardening. You want to go legal, if you want to go social, if you want to go spiritual, if you want to go science. Gardening is the perfect elixir to this canisterization, and that's what I was talking to Kate about in the car on the way here. You know, we're in these times where everything's canistered. Oh, we need science. It's got to be science. No, I mean, I'm stoked that, you know, everything that
that Mark and Kate were talking about is this fusion of, what did you, I wrote it down here, where is it? Interdisciplinary field of environmental humanities. That's what we need. We need to bust it down. We need to rip these canisters out and talk about these things for the value that they are. I'm a patron or ambassador or something for this United Nations RCE, which is the Rural Centre for Expertise, and they're doing similar things to what Kate's talking about and Mark's talking about. Using the university in the state to do the studies on these projects, on community arts, on various arts, on social enterprises, so that they get the study and then they can get serious funding to support this as a proper social support. Not, oh, isn't this great? You know, here's $50 and go and buy a compost bin, we've got a grant. That's just a debt. I don't want $50, I want $500,000 through the health side of things, to run a proper study that employs people writing papers and saying, right, this little social enterprise down in Wodonga, which is the community centre which grows the food and is churning out 180 or 200 meals a night, we want a study on that so that they can get proper funding because they're supporting the community larger than any other government-led thing, so we need this. So I'm very excited about this interdisciplinary stuff. And community gardens are that place because we can break down these barriers and we can do studies on these things. I went to Broome the other day, last weekend, and they started up they actually don't have a community garden. By definition, but I thought about it, it's not. They have a thing called the Incredible Edible, and that started when I went up there 2 years ago, and I said to them, you need to get a group together and do a veggie swap, like they're doing in Mildura. And in Mildura, they did a veggie swap on the weekends that they don't have a market. And so they started a veggie swap. And then people would come in, and you bring in cucumbers, and you've got lots of beans, and people would do that. It's not as you all said, it's not about the veggies. Veggies are the conduit. Oh, veggies are great. There's no chemicals on them and they're growing organically and they're fantastic. But it's about people coming together. And so if you didn't have veggies, like you might have a garden, you might be a student living here on campus, you can take the food waste and trade it. You can go and get the coffee grounds from the cafe and trade it. So suddenly you see all this crossover. And that has thrived. That went from the day after I spoke, someone came in the next morning and said, here's 25 names on a list. When I was there last weekend, they're up to almost 500. And that's a lot in a small town. That is a powerful social group that can knock someone out of a political post. I'm serious. 500 people, because that's 500 individuals. What about the family? So is community gardening political? My God, it is. Of course it is. But that's a good thing. No, we can't just sit there and... It's not happy clappy. Community gardens are the big thing. They are the big thing because they're being demanded. They're being demanded by communities. Communities are going out in gorilla and just go, what are we going to make? Let's find these patches in towns and do it. Ocean Grove, I was down in Geelong for the Sustainable Living Festival. Ocean Grove Primary School. They made a new path and put some plants in and they've got chickens and they've got a community garden going on. But imagine this, on a Friday morning at 7:30 in the morning, I went down to visit the school. There was all 200 kids, plus 250 kids and 200 community people, families, parents, community, turned up at 7:30 on a Friday morning and it was a curriculum day. So no one had to be there. Why were they there? Because, and it's not me, they want to proudly show off their community garden. I was a recipient of that goodwill, and it was amazing. But what I'm saying is, that goodwill is there, and people want this, they're behind it, they're supporting it. Went to school community garden up at Tin Can Bay, north of the Sunshine Coast there. So what are they doing? They're value adding the layers now. they have the men's shed in school. So all of that, all of those seminars, all of that wonderful experience, they bring all their layers, they bring all those things, and then they tinker and they fix and they repair and they rebuild and they upcycle and they recycle and they do everything they do. And they brought the CWA in. And they brought the unemployed program in. So imagine being unemployed and you're just down and things aren't going so well. You go to school, just the sound of kids playing makes you feel good. But then you go there and you've got the elders saying to you, here's a pushback, ride in tomorrow. You suddenly start to ride, you start to get that self-esteem you're talking about, so start to build that confidence. And that's bringing in the community around a school garden. And you see how these synergies can break through because of that concept of a community garden. I went to the opening of a community garden in Portland Quarry. This one will not get out. Sunday morning, the mayor turns up, local member, state member, federal member. That never happens, right? That never happens. Why did it happen here? Because there's a movement at the ranch. And they sort of said, at the opening of a community garden, there's only 250 people. Because I don't know if you've ever seen a community garden that loaded up and chipped. People could die, could be Armageddon. Close to 800 people turned up on a Sunday morning when everyone's got a myriad of sports and activities and so on. 800 people turned up. Remember the best thing about this community garden? Well, the second best thing. Goes back to vocabulary. Want to know the name of it? Anyone know? What's the name of it? The Paul McGuire Community Garden. No. It's not. It's called The Lost Plot. And again, that's that vocabulary. We call it the Greater Armadale Community Garden, and people put the lost plot. People turn up and they're into it and that garden's thriving. The next thing I opened the following day was at the library. And this is Mark, you like this. They have opened up a free seed library. And basically, you go into the library, you might have some seeds. You know that? What's your name?
Tom.
Tom. Tom. Yes, Tom's Tasty Tomatoes. May 2015. You put some seeds in there. And then you can go and pick up some of Louise's Luscious Lebanese.
Leeks.
Leeks? Again, the vocabulary. You've got to talk about it. You've got to flower it up. And so you take some of the leeks. She comes in and goes, oh, it's from Tasty Tomatoes, I'll take some of those. But Piggy hasn't got any. She's bummed out. So no, Piggy can go in and have some seeds. All she has to do is grow and bring some in at the end of the season. Now here we have a living, rolling seed bank. And what it does is it informs people about the next layer that Mark's doing. So when someone then talks about it, or when someone's talking about funding something, or someone's talking about doing something, the community has the value. And then they'll fire up if the ethics aren't correct. They will fire up and say, no, you can't do that because that's Indigenous knowledge, you should be sacred to those people. The people will know because they go, well, these are our seats, you can't come and take them, you can't own them, you cannot own those things. And then it might fire them up in a broader perspective and say, well, they might be manipulated, tampered with seeds. So then you suddenly have another whole new layer of learning. And it comes out of something simple. And all of you, like I asked one of you here to take it on and set one up here at Armadale Library. All you need is some brown paper bags. You can speak to them. When I was in Broome last week, I was talking, and at the end of my talk, I said, and I'd just like to say that this is my officially last visit here ever. What's upsetting? I said, but if you set up a seed library, I'll come back. And so I went to the men's shed, because at the expo they had all the community groups, and I said, guys, you got anything, maybe put some sets in and, you know, blah, 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 or make something. Blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, actually, we got all the fit out from an old music store, and all the old CD boxes. Yeah, we can fit them onto a piece of timber and sit it up, and then you can put them in there. That'll be set up probably within about 2 weeks. So, you know, we can do this. We it doesn't have to be a doctoral paper. We can support that doctoral paper by putting it out into our achievable ways. You know, I got asked by a particular newspaper if I'd go and give out some seeds during the school holidays. People say, oh, it's that particular newspaper. And I said, yeah, I'm not going to go out to anyone. I'm not going to be. And they said, well, you come up and give out some seeds in this town. And I said, it's not like I come from just one, I can do 3 towns. So I spoke at these news agents, and each time I said, okay, well, where's the local library, and then set this up. The news agents, and he said, yeah, we'll supply the other bags. So each and every one of you can ride this. You can step into the saddle in very simple ways, and you've all got skills. Next week, I'm launching the Hobart City Farm. That's another form of community garden. Last week, the Sydney City Farm got its $1.6 million funding through the Sydney City Council. Educational facilities. Non-intimidating, non-aligned, independent, but incredibly politically powerful. Okay. I'll wrap. Just warming up.
By way of introduction.
the other thing I launched last week was New South Wales Young Farmers Federation City Branch. If we're going to change the food system, it has to happen in the city. Farmers can't do it. They have to do it without support. So to launch something like that is incredibly powerful. And how do we get people understanding their food? We get them to become urban farmers, balcony farmers, rooftop farmers, vertical wall farmers. Again, vocabulary, get people in. Yes, you are now, you can join it. I was in Melbourne the other day helping establish a legal defence fund, a grower consumer legal defence fund, to help change the status quo where the industry's control is being put on the small farmer and busting them. And it's us that need to say, hey, I'm happy to slip a 50 in there so that when someone brings up this small farmer and says, you know, you can't do this, or the food police come, they can get on the phone, 24-hour legal support, and they can talk the talk. So there's all these layers. So you may be legal. You may be able to help support that. So keep an eye out for that. Regenerative agriculture, I won't go in that. And the only other one that I wanted to finish with, almost 25 hours. It's Greek time anyway. Greek time, it's 10 hours. the only other thing was, in Broome the other day, there's a project going on at the table for a wonderful, wonderful fellow who's working with the local community up there. He's been working on this project for close to 10 years. Sorry, we'll put it, that'll be the first seat. Maybe we could have a university one, but that's the thing. The reason I say out at the library, because then it's not the responsibility of the incredible learning. It's not in someone's garage. It's in a public space where everyone can get from 9 to 5 every day, and it's not a problem. So, right, thanks for that. So anyway, the last thing I wanted to say, they've been working with 5 or 6 farming members with the local workers there to bring the landscape back to where it was, which was open woodland. And when they manage it like that, within two cool burns, they bring it back to open woodland, get rid of the dense acacia which takes over and then creates a hot fire which absolutely wreaks havoc on the trees. They brought that back, and then in that, they're now growing medicinal, therapeutic, and edible plants that are significant to them. The gubbins in particular. And they're growing them in woodland setting. All they're doing is adding a little bit of drip irrigation to get them up and away in the first couple of years. Now, if you ask me, do you have community gardens? And look at the public dialogue that's going on. We have a public political dialogue saying we want people off the land. The land needs people on it. It needs the communities to remain where they are. What the communities need is everything that we said earlier, Steve, is that support and that knowledge that they can do it. They're their way. Take it off this forced grip. And here's the opportunity. You get a food right, you get a community garden in there, get food right, and then start to do this style of agriculture, which is in the setting of the bush. But the plants, it's not a white fella form of agriculture, it's a bulldozer and braiding the lines, and yet it's not going to work. It's got to grow in its natural setting. And they're doing that. And that, to me, is one of the most exciting things I've ever seen.
And I'm so excited about it. But anyway, I won't go on about that. I'll finish off by saying, at the end of the day, we are the community. Community gardens drive dialogue. Every mouthful, every dollar, every action we take matters. And we can drive change. And I like what you said, Mark, about collect, catalogue, store, access and use. And I think that's everything that a community garden represents. It collects the knowledge. It connects the people. It collects the people from the elders to the kids and everyone in between. And all the cultures, as Steve said. It catalogues information. It stores that information and distributes it again as education. It's accessible because it's non-intimidating. And then gets out and uses it. So the last bit here was, how long do you want me to go for? That's it. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. I think we've probably got about 5 minutes for those who want to stick around for a bit of an open floor discussion, and then I've got to rush Costa off to Minimbar to do some stuff with the kids. So, yeah, if anybody has any questions, please, for any of the talkers, please.
Just a lot of seed only lasts for a year in terms of viability. What do they do about that? Just collect it again the next year, or what do they get more seed?
Yeah, then they store stuff.
And it's funny because when I made that book, all the kids sat around and saying,
from when things, big things grow, and you use that as a motif for the film. I think it's where the garden kind of ran into the play area that went into running around the wall. The whole thing was very integrated, and the teacher was in there with them, not standing there going, right, you guys, run around the oval, I'll just stand here and watch you. And that's really important. Just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Did it take to go from the garden to get a bit sort of starting with beds and going to different parts?
Yeah. So, yeah, we've just started to really end up on seasons as it's turned out. crazy. But we've just started playing some sort of winter veggies and hardy herbs and stuff like that. We got a grant from Inspiring Australia, which is Southern National Science Room. So, pretty much that to do bush food and medicine. And also the lot of stuff around Aboriginal astronomy, because it speaks so much to different molecules and stuff. So that's where it's going.
Yeah.
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 Beck, how will you manage the garden? Who will become the comfortable working?
Yeah, look, we're hoping that the open day will get a lot of people interested.
I'm new to Armadale. So where is this garden? Is it near the old tip?
Sort of. So it's do you know where Bunnings is?
Yes.
So if you drive up from Bunnings, it's actually on Mossman Street goes over, but there's an overlay called Ruby Park Oval. And it's at the edge of that.
So you Google that. Left hand arms.
Yeah, you turn left. Yeah. And it's between there and Mossman Street, the big football field, and it's the last block.
You'll be the driving of the band.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's the last one.
But, when it comes to getting people around and then once I'm sure that they're paid and follow up, and used to catch up with it, to say, oh, let's meet and have a hypothermos down there and meet someone and catch up with a friend there and just expose people. It's more expose people. At the end of the day, all of you here are agents of the success of this because we're here. If you share that information, but again, it doesn't have to be in your face. It's just going to be like, oh, I don't know, you do it, I'm going to be an effort. Half an hour, it's doing good work. If you have the kids, go down and have a look, and walk down there regularly, you just influence. Like, on my street back when I was doing that, first time, I remember, you got a job, like, I got my bucket set, first time the job was going, oh, my God. And then the second time, they go, oh, you had the right hand. So that's kind of a good start. Then the third time, they go, hello, you think, oh. Then the fourth time, they say it's looking good. Oh, you want to try a tomato? But this time they stop. So it's just impatience.
I've known that you quite a connection between the one in that gully and you can go out and say,
And the challenge is, we've started one in Nara last year. It's got the men's shed, the community college got a big group. Community in there, but the money's run out now, the impetus has run out. So the challenge now is to invigorate that in our part of the world, worse than Armadale. You can't grow anything, but you can't grow stuff. It's not a nice day for the day, no. So that's our next challenge now, to try and make that happen. We can get going, so we'll go with that one.
Will there be opportunities
if
people to acquire skills? I can do rather than now, not more immediately, but I grew up in a concrete yard. So people who would like to get involved but just manage to get
involved. There will definitely be. It's once we get, inequalities involved and kind of do a bit of an informal audit about what people actually know, what they can offer.
Yeah, there. And then they might bring your confidence back in.
That's been the model of the one that Kelly, where people don't have individual allotments. Everyone
There's a model in a little garden in Redfern, just off Cleveland Street. And when I say a little garden, it's a little cobble park. And they've got one, two, three, four big beds. You know, when I say big, I'm talking big. Beds like this. And their model, which I really like, is that if you become a new member, well, you can pick, you know, go in the shade, in the sun, in the veggie, or in the dirt, and you start there, and then you rotate through the four beds, and that way you meet everyone, and then you can decide which one, or you just keep going like that. So there's lots of quirky little, like I said before, each garden has its quirky little ways. And you know, from that layer to this layer of, and you can go into what you're saying about, relying on that drip feed, like the funding, it then needs to amp up, and when this whole movement is growing strength, and not just something, it's growing real strength. And with each piece of strength that it builds, it's leveraged to get recognition and then proper funding through council, because this is a recognised community activity, and that's when you actually have to step forward and say to the local members, look at what's going on here. Here's a paper on it, here's this, or this many people are coming, we want some funding out of the council budget, because we're saving money, we're recycling all this waste here, it's reducing the tipping fees, and you know, you start...
Yeah, but everything was more of a problem, that's all I think you have to do, council, yeah. And that's some of the attitude, really.
Yeah, well... So
we're going to push hard here.
And that's it, you just got to keep, just, you know, the pressure and then the temperature continues to shift.
I can want to stick water maybe on the size of the tubs. Yeah, that's how petty you can get.
Israel has shown us by good feeding and turn the president into a really good basis. What type of water system are you going to set up in this
environment? We've looked at that. We've looked into the town water, the council, those that are on the greenhouse water for free. And we have Peter Hall, who's our project manager, designed and with the tank training school, a really good irrigation system. Yeah, but probably just one more question.
These community gardens in cities are an opportunity to try and change how we do agriculture. We are 99% of the land. With your broad scale agriculture producing really bland, sometimes. Without much
competition. 5,000%, no question, because that's making people think about their food. Probably one of the biggest things that's happened in agriculture in the last 6 weeks or 8 weeks was the food industry, because that's made people realise that they bought and had hepatitis A sitting in their freezer. And it doesn't matter how hip the smoothie recipe was, you were mixing it up with Hep A because there was, and then it fires up the whole thing about transparency with labelling, the fact that they've grown in South America, taken to Asia, really containerised it, taken to New Zealand, put in a nice happy man, and it must be good at it, and put red colours on there and all of this. And then sell it back into Australia as a product of Australia and New Zealand, may contain imported and local ingredients. The only local ingredient is the cardboard box. And so you know, that's terrible for those people that got sick. But that's the tipping point, because now people are saying, well, what's happening with the labour here? You know, there's labour. There's slave labour on our farms because we're not paying proper. Whereas, you know, there was a big fire up about, oh, let's get more people to control these things in Canberra. But then you say, okay, you're paying $6.50 for manners. Who's paying for those extra 400 people to check an extra 10 boxes a month? We are. So if you say we're paying for it, then you jack the price up from $6.50 a kilo, closer to the probably $10 a kilo that the ones from Australia order. And then you buy them when they're in season, so suddenly this is making people think about agriculture. Buy them when they're in season, they're worth $5 a kilo, freeze them yourself. Got a bit of dirt under your fingernail, that's all right. It's not food that's come from, you know, uncontrolled sources. So, yeah, the community garden is an incredible way. That's making farming lock and lock.
Yeah,
people, it's new, it's making farming really front and centre, and people realise it. Seasonality, local, going there, knowing the farm. You know, the Canberra Growers Market, my godson's been working down there. They sold 8,000 eggs, and this is a mobile chicken operation, free range, 8,000 eggs in 2 hours, because people come back. And then, I was standing there, and they were blowing up, and they got there at 10, and I was like, so this is it. You know, the Growers Market is changing the food landscape. The big players are worried, because it's 20% and growing. So yeah, they're a wonderful program of change.
Thank you so much.